This podcast is brought to you by Mad Company, a nonprofit theater company based out of New York City.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of One Hail of a Conversation. My name is James Hale. I am your host for this podcast. With me today, I have the immense pleasure of being seated next to Robert Bradvica, actor, stage manager, director extraordinaire.
All kinds of stuff. I'm kind of dipping my toes in everything. Hello. That name is hysterical, though. One Hail of a Conversation.
I giggle every time.
It's great.
So... first things first, you and I met, would have been a little over a year ago. Yep. We both were doing the same show. You were stage managing. Mm-hmm. I was one of the actors in a show at the Gene Frankel Theater in Manhattan. Most recently, you just closed. You closed yesterday,
we had closed,
right?
Saturday. Yeah, Saturday. Loadout was Sunday and all that, yeah.
Excellent. So you just closed a show again at the Gene Frankel. You've worked there a lot, this time as an actor. Mm-hmm. I really want to get into that, but first, I just want to hear a little bit about your background.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up? What training do you have? Sort of, what's your, give us your bio.
Yeah. So, first thing I ever did stage-wise was in fifth grade. I grew up in San Diego, so California, Southern California native. I've been out in New York for about 8 years now. First thing I ever did, fifth grade, there was the San Diego Youth Opera was kind of touring around different elementary schools. They'd put on a production for a couple months.
Okay.
A lot of fun. And they did Rip Van Winkle at my elementary school, and the first thing I ever did was I was Henry Hudson in that, which was a musical, which is funny because I have not followed through on the musical side of things, much more straight play or production side of things. But I was in that, and that is kind of where I got the theater bug. I did a lot of, well, not a lot of, I went to a lot of auditions in middle school. My father would drive me up to LA. Being only a couple hours away, it was kind of easy. Somewhat. He'd take off work. He loved doing that stuff. A couple of times in my life, I've heard him say that if he could, he would have quit whatever job he had and just been my manager, if that could have been financially viable for him, because he just really enjoyed being a part of that stuff. So he would drive me up to L.A. a lot. Didn't do a whole lot in that period. I was in kind of an indie movie, one or two of those, and a commercial. But then things really kicked off when I got into high school. The high school I went to had a really, really robust theater program with two phenomenal drama teachers. Shout out Greg Osborne and Paul Reams. Hopefully they'll listen to this. There's something about having a good theater teacher when you're growing up that really keeps a passion for this kind of thing alive. A lot of the world just doesn't encourage you to pursue this stuff. Even when it does, it's always couched with, you know, okay, think about the other thing you're going to do as well. What's the backup plan? What's the plan B? What are you going to do when it doesn't work out? So even people that want you to do this stuff, they're not fully encouraging in the way that they are with, say, like, I want to be a scientist. Oh, fantastic. They throw everything they can at you.
Yeah.
Once they hear you want to do a theater thing, they're like, oh God. And they get, I think it comes from a place of fear because it's so well known how hard it is to really make something happen in this industry.
Totally, yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't understand how many avenues you have to pursue once you explore this. Like, there's teaching, there's all kinds of production side of things, stage managing, crew stuff. So there's a lot more. When you say, like, I want to be a theater artist, they always think, oh, you're going for the lead role in every big play possible. That's tough.
I shall only be the protagonist ever.
Exactly. And so people are not as encouraging as they could be. And so to have two teachers that really just pushed us to continue to explore the theater arts and expand our craft and talk about it in a way where that was their life. Yes, they were teaching high school and they had other classes to teach and whatnot, but they were very clearly theater professionals and theater artists first, and that was what they instilled in us. And I feel very lucky to have worked with those two. And so throughout my high school career, I did about 11 shows. They were able to do 3 shows a year at my high school, which is
This was called something like Highland Player?
Oh, yeah. So I went to Helix Charter High School out in San Diego. Shout out them as well. It was the Highland Players was the name of our theater troupe, partly because way back in like the 50s, Helix High School split off from another high school that was in the area, and they were called the Grossmont Foothillers. And so literally just to be kind of petty, they were like, well, we're the Highlanders.
The Highlands and the Foothills.
Just to say they had the high ground on them. Right. So that was the name of the little troupe. We had something called the Little Theater for a while. And also my high school got this like really nice expansion on the Performing Arts Center when I was a senior. So we got like a black box theater and a big main stage, which I think would have been considered an off-Broadway seat-wise.
I was looking this up before you came over, and initially from the Googling, it was hard to tell that this was a high school troupe. Like, it seemed like this semi-professional, professional troupe in Southern California.
Honestly, it is almost closer to that than not, especially recently. I knew that they were consummate professionals, my teachers, in the San Diego area, But I didn't quite know what kind of connections they had. A couple of years ago, they did, shoot, was it Rent? Or I think it was it Rent? No, West Side Story. I want to say they did West Side Story, and they were able to get the touring Broadway set, or the national touring set, to the high school. Yeah, so they were using the actual set they used on the national tour at this high school.
Okay.
So I didn't realize they had those kinds of connections. So when you're talking about them being semi-professional, that is, in terms of the production side and the quality that they put shows on for, I would say it's a young semi-professional program.
That's incredible. And
the fact they do three shows a year consistently, and they obviously make enough money to keep doing three shows a year.
Sustainably, yeah.
In this big enough space, it's a phenomenal program. And I only got to touch my toes into that big space the last kind of half of my senior year. I did two shows in that space. And the funniest thing about that is I got in there freshman year, and my drama teacher was telling the seniors, like, okay, you know, we're going to get this next year, or like, I know you guys just missed it, but we're going to get this. And then it just never quite happened.
Oh, no.
That's like local school bureaucracy, though. That's just how it happens. So I did that, and then I spent a year at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, where the program actually ended up closing down or losing money halfway through my first year. And so that school has now since shuttered. And then I moved over to the New York Conservatory for Dramatic Arts,
okay.
Where I've been for 2 years, or I went for 2 years for a total of 3 years of school. So, and since then I've been living in the city doing my thing.
What program were you at the conservatory?
The AA that I got was like a communications with a focus in film and television.
Okay.
But it was a film and television focused school. They had an optional third year for theater that I did not do.
Okay.
But even since I've been out, my focus has largely been theater work as opposed to film and television. I've done a couple of student film things. And I have a friend of mine that has a production company down in Alabama that we want to work on some stuff. But for the most part, my focus has ended up being theater. I've fallen into that more often.
Amazing.
That's where my focus has been. I've always loved theater. I kind of get that sense of accomplishment more out of theater than I do film sometimes.
I would agree with that. It's also, I mean, I'm more recent to the city than you are, 4 years ago.
Right.
But it just seems like the way into theater is a little bit more open than the way into film and television.
Sure.
Like you kind of have to break in a fairly significant way to really be able to work in film and television in New York versus, I mean, everyone I know who's in any way interested in theater can get involved in a decent level of theatrical production in the city.
Yeah, I think the city does a good job of having, they have like the New York Winterfest, Summerfest, they got all these festivals that have a lot of brand new playwrights doing their stuff, so there's a lot of opportunity there. It's the amount of non-ex stuff is really nice, so if you're a non-union, it's easy. And you got like small little theaters like the Gene Frankel that have a lot of history that give you a chance to get in front of some fairly prolific people in a fairly simple way, which is really, really nice.
Absolutely.
And even with the small size like that, it still feels good to be doing it.
Right. It's working out those creative muscles.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But so speaking of Gene Frankel, excellent segue.
Right.
you have worked there at least twice that I know of.
Four times.
Okay.
Three and a half, but I can specify.
How do you work there? How do you work there?
So the first half time was that it was over the summer of 2022, I think. Yeah, it would have been 2022. They were doing a production of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Right.
And a friend of mine was stage managing at the time, and she had ended up getting COVID partway through. So they had hit me up when I was on vacation. They're like, yeah, like if you know anyone that can stage manage that needs to fill in, that'd be great. We need the help. I was like, yeah, I'll ask around. I think I asked a couple people. They couldn't do it. And then right before I was going to be home for vacation, they were like, hey, do you just want to jump in and do it? I was like, I mean, I'll be home for it, sure. So I jumped in for the last like week and a half or so of production. I think I did a week where I was stage managing partway through the run. And then me and the stage manager swapped back and forth. Partly because they already better, they were testing negative, but then I kind of wanted to keep doing it. So I was like, we can just swap off days, or, you know.
Right.
So I did. So that's like the half a time
Sure. We'll count that as half.
Right.
So with all these different hats that you wear, the different wells that you dip toes into, how do you balance the different desires of particularly a theater artist? Like, do you say, for this period of time, I want to focus on directing something? I'm only looking to stage manage for a while. Time is purely for acting.
That's the funny thing is I don't balance it.
Okay.
It is just whatever whims. It's whatever opportunities present themselves.
Sure.
So the only reason I was able to dip my toes into directing and producing was because shortly out of school, I was in a production of a play, an original piece, part of one of the New York Winterfests.
Okay.
And the writer of that kind of asked me to help him start his fledgling theater company. And so for a couple of years, I worked with that. And so I got a chance to produce a couple of one-act festivals, and we produced a version of Macbeth that premiered up until March 14th of 2020, which was kind of the last
and then what happened, Rob?
Some fun. We all wanted to stay home for a while. We all collectively decided it's time to breathe.
Yeah. And then nothing happened, weirdly.
Yeah, so that we had some good momentum, and then obviously that was a bit truncated, I guess. Yeah.
Force majeure.
Yeah, right. So I was able, but I got a chance to direct and produce from that side of things, doing that. And that is kind of where I feel like I've developed a decent theatrical instinct for directing.
Okay.
And I'm currently actually going to be a part of a directing program at the Barrow Group going into next year.
Oh, wow, okay.
Like a year-long thing, January through November. And so the reason I want to do that is because while I feel like I can say, like, I've got decent theatrical directing instincts, whatever, I would like to apply some kind of, like, vocabulary or theory or foundation behind that.
A structure.
Yeah, so that I can really start pursuing that as something serious. Because there's a couple of, my brother's a playwright as well, and the couple of shows he's written, I want to direct, and again,
absolutely,
I've got ideas for that. As I've mentioned to you before, I've got a version of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead that I want to direct, and I can wave those ideas around and say, look, I promise I know what I'm talking about, but just having a little bit of, credibility, I guess,
yeah, of course,
on a resume saying, no, I've studied this, I do have a foundation. Right. I think that'll help me in saying, I can do this, I promise, until I get more experience and then I can say, no, I can't do this because I've been hired to do
until
it before.
Until you're recognized as such. Yeah.
Exactly.
What is this program at the Barrow Group? Is
it? It's a year-long directing program. It's broken up into three different sections. I think the first one you work on scenes, the next one you work on a short, or a scenes from a larger play in this program.
Oh, okay.
And then the last one is like putting on a short play for yourself. It's an 8-person program, I believe. And I'm convinced they do that a little bit to get you to jump in as fast as you can. They like keep it. They're like, it's only 8 spots.
That's right. No, yeah.
But I'm assuming it's fairly selective. They said it's like an intermediary professional program.
Yeah.
So people that are not quite working consistently, but do have designs for,
absolutely,
and maybe have some experience.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited. And I love the small size of the class, actually. It'll be great to get to know the other directors there and have time to explore each of our whatever we're doing there.
Absolutely.
So I'm very excited. I'm also taking an acting class there as well in tandem, which they recommend and everything. Because it's like the directing is being, being taught how to direct the Barrow Group style.
Oh, okay.
You know,
the Barrow method.
Whatever that happens to be, which I'm sure is a conglomeration of a bunch of different methods.
As
distilled.
They all are.
Right,
yeah,
they all have touches of something in there.
Of course.
So I'm very excited about that. Good Lord, what was the question that got me into this?
I don't remember.
My balancing all my different... Yeah, it's mainly based on opportunity. I had a chance to stage manage twice in a row, so I took it. The next thing, and then I made sure to tell him, like, I want to be offered the chance to perform first, and if I can, I will gladly stage manage again, because as long as I'm a part of theater in some way, I'm happy. But I wanted the chance to audition first, and the last two things I've done, I've luckily been able to be a part of. In the spring, I was a part of Teach Me How to Die. I was able to be part of that, and then this production this winter. And I know that Thomas Gordon, the operating manager and artistic director of the Gene Frankel and Onomatopoeia Theater Company, he is working on something coming this summer. So I want to keep in his orbit. I like that he hires me. That it feels
yes,
good.
I mean,
very appreciative of it.
That's the best thing.
finding those people. That's what I've discovered networking is just meeting people that'll hire you.
Right. Absolutely. That's the best part of it. You are good at this because that's another fabulous segue.
God, I should do podcasts.
You should do podcasts. Take my job. Don't take my job.
It's fine.
So
one Bradvica of a conversation does not roll off the tongue the same, I will say.
Workshop that.
Right.
So the play you were just a part of that I want to get into, called You Are Not Alone, A Modern Romantic Adventure. You mentioned it was written by Thomas Gordon, who does quite a lot of work, especially at the Gene Frankel, his sort of home turf. So you were the lead in the show. You played a character named Dr. Charles Vash.
Vash, yes.
Who is, here's what I got from it.
Okay.
He is a medical doctor, a scientist who gets into sort of alchemical, mystical sciences.
Yep.
Feels a little bit like Doctor Strange.
A bit,
like,
yeah, definitely.
Just kind of really smart guy, gets into...
In the initial draft of the script, there's a couple times I do magic spells, and initially they had wanted me to do the icon of...
I love you. You did that on stage once.
Did I actually?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Or maybe not that.
There's another character that I know for a fact does that. Initially in the script, I had to do the I love you symbol for sign language. For those that don't know, pinky up, forefinger up, and thumb out. I was supposed to do that. So that was very Doctor Strange and like the hand motion. And then on top of that, they had me hold this massive book of illustrated the complete works of Shakespeare illustrated. That's what that meant it was. And so I had to hold that. And partway through tech, I realized I'm never going to get a chance to actually do the hand motion because that book is about 10
big.
Pounds.
Yeah.
And I had to keep that in my hands at all times. So I was told to do the I love you thing and I never got a chance to. But another character in the show who also does a spell got to incorporate that instead. So it still made its
way.
Very
cool.
But yes, very Doctor Strange in the way that works.
So we part of the Marvel multiverse. So this was an original piece written and directed by Thomas. Your character Kate, who is your wife, girlfriend fiance, girlfriend, disappears, or we think dies one day about 5 years before the events of the play, and then you take this sort of mystical journey through different dimensionality, through time space to find her. And that's the story. Eventually you do kind of reconnect. Spoiler alert, you do kind of reconnect. And I'm curious, all sorts of things in this play that I'm sure were very fun, very challenging to work on. What I really like to ask people who work on original pieces, and especially when the writer is so intimately involved in the day-to-day, the direction, like how is that as a performer finding your own voice in a character that's never existed before and incorporating notes from the person who basically created this character that you now have to inhabit?
It's interesting. I've now done this twice. The show that I was in the spring was also an original piece.
Thomas's other show, of course.
And the playwright was in that show as well, so the playwright was there and very much involved. But I would say this is a much different process, actually. Thomas, the way he directs is very loose. I've gotten the chance to work with several directors, and there are some that will come in ready to go with kind of where you're supposed to be. You need to move here. Your job as an actor is to figure out why you're moving there. This one is much looser in that there was no skeleton. There was no bones yet. A lot of what the rehearsal process was not figuring out why we moved somewhere, but where are we going to move? And so there's kind of an extra layer of, while there's some freedom in getting the chance to shape it yourself, you do, I think, miss out a little bit on really focusing in on the why you're doing stuff when you're also building the skeleton on top of that. So it's extra challenging because you're having to put the shape to it yourself. And Thomas, as the director, now has to worry about shaping it on top of hearing the words for the first time on stage and all that. So one of the nice things about having the director there as the playwright is that we can change stuff. we can get to a line and go, hey, this doesn't quite read great.
Right.
And one of the phenomenal things about Thomas is that he is not one to go, well, I wrote that this way, I need you
He's not precious about it.
No. And he's precious in the sense that he obviously cares about the script he's written and the themes and keeping the characters the right way. But he was very willing to let us experiment with the actual lines and the actual order of words and whatnot. And even up until a couple of shows into the run, we were adjusting things on what response from the audience was and what worked and what we felt like didn't work. And blessing in disguise, Thomas wasn't at a lot of the productions, and so we were able to kind of have some freedom in changing things up and seeing how things worked. And it was a much bigger ensemble feeling piece than a lot of them that I've been a part of, because like I said, even into the run, we as a cast were trying to find what worked and what didn't,
of course.
And so we were really, really having to listen to each other and work together all the way through the show to make this thing work. So it was nice having that freedom to just change things kind of as we see fit, while still maintaining the thrust of the plot and the themes that are present. But we got to adjust what words were said.
Right, you get to do what you want with it. Yeah,
it was great.
I also found it feels to me, as I saw it last week, week before, I can't remember. But it felt like it fell into this kind of interesting, slightly strange place presentationally of... This is a incredibly well envisioned workshop, maybe, because it's the first production ever.
Bottom
of
the script
show.
Says 1.0, V1.0.
Does it? Yeah. So it's this really interesting because there are so many of these elements that clearly are being worked on throughout the rehearsal process, even as you say, show to show. But it's also very much, you know, the extra theatrical pieces were there. There's this full set, there's a huge cast of, what was it,
eight or nine of us,
Like, that's a large workshop cast. So it falls sort of in between this, like, we're working on this for later, and this is our final product. Which I wonder if, were there any discussions around, like, not the purpose of showing this, but any discussions during rehearsal around this is what Tom has wanted to get out of it? Is he hoping to show it again?
I know for a fact he's mentioned that he would like to expand it and bring us back and everything. He had also mentioned that he had gone through several, I guess, point something drafts before this. So he had done his own rewriting and everything.
Of course.
I feel like there's the nugget of the story and the nugget of the theme. I think all of that is really, really nice. The general theme is basically working today to make tomorrow better, making sure that you know, what you shouldn't put off. What's the phrase? What you could do today.
Don't put shit off to tomorrow.
Yeah, basically that. If you can do it today, don't put it off to tomorrow. Right. Work on today. If you do good work today, tomorrow is going to be better, et cetera, et cetera. So the theme is great. I think the general thrust of this kind of like out of time alchemist doctor in kind of real time, but also like mid 2010s a bit, because there's a little bit of time travel. Yeah. I think all of that's really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And I think as the cast, I think we really found some nice things about the characters, some nice depth in the relationships and everything. There's some really nice romantic aspects. I love that it's a happy ending. Spoilers again, sorry. Yeah. it's a happy ending based on some old Chinese myths. I think you mentioned something about like the monkey god or something, where there's a Chinese myth that this monkey god gets tricked by the other elder gods or whatever into making his monkey people imprisoned by them or something. And he goes to these gods and tricks them into signing this contract where, you know, they're like, if you give us your soul, we'll release your monkey friends. And he's like, okay, I'll do that. But then he tricks them and crosses their names off and makes all monkeys immortal or something. It's loosely based on some Chinese mythology.
Interesting. Okay.
And that's something similar happens at the end. Yeah. We like trick the devil, they gets put to sleep, and I cross out names on a contract and we sign that anyways. And so it's really, I hesitate to say simple, but it is relatively simple and childlike, but in a very positive way.
Yeah,
it's very innocent. It's a lot of love, strong today, and that's how you're going to make tomorrow better. Love, hope, reconnection, reconciliation, understanding, communication, all that kind of stuff, which I think gets overlooked in a lot of modern storytelling for how depressing things are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely the desire to sometimes move things into a darker, yeah, more tragedy-driven place because that can feel closer to reality.
Right. And it's almost like, even if it's a generally happy story, it's finding hope within this really dark and bleak thing. And the nice thing about this production, it kind of a little disappointingly that we didn't find out really as a cast until partway through the run, where it's the whole thing's happy. Even because there is the subject of suicide gets brought up a little bit. Presumably, through the course of the play, it's presumed that my love interest killed herself, and that is why I'm searching for her and bringing her back. But it turns out she was tricked by this vision for this demon character, and so she didn't actually kill herself, and she was actually just like in limbo or purgatory or something.
Right.
But it's all still happy. Everything that's happening is joyous for the most part, and that's kind of what's missing, I think, from a lot of storytelling nowadays. Everything there's this trend to be, like you said, in an effort to be realistic, things just get really dark and depressing, and there's not a lot of just straight happy endings,
right,
where the characters win, get married, and love each other by,
right,
the end. There's a kid, congratulations, the devil's defeated, and it's nice and refreshing. And from what Thomas had told us closing night, is a lot of the feedback he got was that people walked away feeling really good about that part of it, is that it ended well, and there was nothing to grapple with. That was, it ended well, but, or did he do the right, like, you know, it was really kind of cut and dry.
Yeah, there's not a lot of ambiguity, at least surrounding the morality, of the story. And I think it was actually very effective, because the tone is pretty pure.
Yeah.
And your character, interestingly, part of this I'm just sort of discovering as we chat about this, but thinking back about it, you have this character who... There are pretty clearly two different timelines. There's the now into the future, and then there's that character looking back. And thinking of this, you play the character now who's pretty jaded, who's unhappy, who's yelling at his father, who's cutting himself off from the world. Feels very clearly like sort of the darker side of the character. And then looking back at the beginning of his love story with Kate, his girlfriend who eventually disappears, and that character feels so full of hope, so not simple but pure. And I wonder, playing that, having to jump back and forth scene to scene between the now and the darkness and the clear desire to go off in time and space and find your girlfriend, and then cut scene, character 6 years ago who's falling in love with this woman and has no guile whatsoever. Like, was that a hard dichotomy?
That
to
was
jump
that, honestly my
between?
Favorite part of doing it, I think, was that initial flop back and forth. And the change really that I feel like all I feel like I did was kind of drop my voice a half an octave between the two.
I didn't notice that. That's so interesting.
I that's what I feel like is all I did. I'm sure, and I hope that there was something deeper in terms of like an acting craft that I like added to the character, or whatever, or like my circumstances.
It's effective, right?
Right. If I'm fooling the audience, that's the important part. But that was honestly one of the more fun parts about it. The first scene opens, like you said, I'm my dad's there, and I'm frustrated at him. He's bothering me. I'm actively working in that moment to make a spell to find my girlfriend again, and so I'm very jaded. I'm only excited about the ingredients I'm finding, and I'm brushing off everyone else that's coming to talk to me. And then right after that, I jump through this portal. I kind of walk over this cauldron area, and I do this annoying quick change where I have to like throw my pants on and off, get a jacket, all that kind of stuff. And so, God, quick changes, man. It was really funny because a lot of the time the cast were like, "Hey, if I can help you, let me know." And I felt bad, but like the only way they could help me was getting completely out of my way and just letting me change my pants.
Right. You can't put my pants on for me.
No,
so.
Like if I know where my stuff is, then I'm happy. No one touch me. I love the cast. They were very, very helpful. They had to do a whole lot of transitions, so they were like in that mind. But that transition was a lot of fun because I go from really throwing some nastiness out at these people to dropping back into this kind of excited professor alchemist role. So one of the exercises we did in rehearsal, Thomas had us, it was a couple of us there, it wasn't the whole cast, but he had us shape the other actors as their character into like a statue that represented aspects of them as the character.
Okay. Little psychological gesture.
And at one point we did like, we moved around as an animal that we thought matched our character. All that shit's like, so can I swear?
Sure. There's not a lot of rules.
Fucking it. No. Okay. a lot of those games feel very silly, purposefully. Right. So I think the silliness loosens you up, because once you get into it and you realize how silly it is, you tend to shed a lot and do more than you would if you were thinking about it more actively. So we do these kind of silly games. But that statue exercise actually stuck with me the entirety of the run. So I have to give Thomas credit for that. Yeah. That was really smart. The way they shaped, the other actors shaped me. Because also the nice thing is that you're not picking a statue shape in this exercise. It's the other actors going, okay, what do we know about your character? And they shape you. And so it wasn't even like my statue idea where I was like, oh, this is how I feel. They did it to me. And I was like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense.
And then you're receiving something from it.
Yeah. Wow. And so the way they shaped me was I had to wear my glasses for the show, which that is the only thing I was upset about, because I wore my glasses last time. My glasses are too big for my face and they slip off. And I was like, I wasn't wearing them the first couple of rehearsals. Thomas is like, hey, can you keep the glasses on? I was like, okay, fine.
No.
It's like, whatever. So I had my glasses on. They had me with my right hand kind of grab the frame, and with the other one it was my left hand was out kind of off in the distance, and I was bent down at the knees, leaned forward, kind of like the Scooby-Doo intro where they're like running and they're kind of leaned forward, and like, you know, like cartoon characters kind of lean forward with their like showing forward momentum or whatever.
Right.
I hope I'm explaining this well, but like it was essentially like Doctor Who, honestly. David Tennant's Doctor Who.
Okay.
Imagine him running down a hallway with a big coat. That was essentially the statue they put me in. And that kind of that energy of about to start running towards something, grabbing my glasses, my hand out, whatever coat I have, kind of drifting, really shaped a lot of the energy I carried into the run. Anytime I was, there were several times when I was backstage in this theater and I would have to run, literally run on stage. And I would essentially just like drop down into that shape backstage. And then whatever my cue was, I'd run from that position, and all that energy, all that kind of kinetic energy the statue position had.
Yeah.
Pushed into the scene and really, really helped with that, especially the past Doctor stuff.
Yeah.
Really helped heighten that energy and that sense of adventure with the heisting. And because he's also steal shit. He's like a thief. It was part of his character.
A lot of lives.
Yeah. Alchemical stuff, Doctor, thief, whatever. And so it's all that kind of adventurous, youthful, naive energy. And that statue position was a lot of where that came from, surprisingly.
That's super cool. That's the making of the psychological gesture and then carrying that onto stage is pretty classic Michael Chekhov psychological gesture.
That's even connected to like some old American theater where I remember learning they had like this textbook for how to do stage acting. This is all prior to the Russian stuff coming over. And they would literally have like, if you were conveying sadness, your feet were like this, your hands were like this.
Oh,
like
sure.
It was all based in gesture. So like sadness is gesture to be. Happiness is gesture for. Like, and so it, even I think as that develops into this kind of psychological stuff where instead of you have to pick a position on stage to tell the audience what you're feeling, you can still use those positions, but then to naturally find that emotion.
You know, that's really interesting. I've never heard of having the actor adopt a pose that someone else puts on them, though.
Right.
I wonder, I mean, I don't know how often you do this exercise, but while doing it, did you find that you both obviously got this very effective gesture from it?
Yeah.
Were there times where you were put into a gesture and you thought, I don't really know if that works, or you received something that like you weren't expecting and didn't want to carry into the character with you?
What was nice about that is we did it the one time.
Okay.
We had like two or three gestures, I think, for each person. And one of them I actually forget, so it clearly wasn't as important to me. But the two that I do remember, the one that I just described being the most impactful. But then there was a second one where somebody else had me like kind of bear hugging a giant cauldron and stirring. And I would say bate, bate, chocolate, which is just stir, stir, chocolate, I think, in Spanish.
Okay.
And so that, I mean, that position didn't carry much over, but that kind of, the silliness behind.
Very fun.
Yeah, and that actually is what stuck with me about that, because I remembered that pose the entire run as well, mainly for the silliness. But again, about halfway through the run, as an ensemble, we all collectively came to the realization that we were kind of missing some of the comedy. We weren't playing it very serious, but we were playing all the characters very real in how they would act in this situation. And I think for the first couple of shows, we missed some of the fun. And then just remembering that, like, you know, stupid little gesture game, and the fact that I was even using one of them so seriously throughout the run, I think that silliness is what stuck with me. Yeah. So not necessarily the actual pose, but what that pose represented in the mood of that rehearsal. And that's what ended up fueling the kind of collective cast realization that we need to be being sillier, and that didn't lose any of the more meaningful moments. It just heightened the funnier ones.
No, totally. So. And actually, I think probably my favorite part of the show was there are a handful of really very moving moments on stage. It tended to be actor to actor, like there were the two hand scenes. You and your father had several really nice moments. You and Kate had several really nice moments. Kate and her mom.
Yes.
So I was very impressed with the quality of the ensemble acting, especially in a show like this that moves really quickly through so many different places, and you're dropped into a fairly unexpected scene, both, you know, temporally in the plot of the show, but also all of a sudden you run on and have this scene with someone you haven't been on stage with before.
Right.
So you and your castmates are very much to be commended for that. As you got to know this cast better, working on original material, was there anything that, so collectively you decided to bring some levity into the show, was there anything that you discovered right away that you thought, this is like something we need to hold on to, or was it pretty much you discover as you went through?
I mean, that's the nice thing about having this show ran for 16 shows. 15, we had one canceled, but we ran for 16 shows, equity showcase rules and everything. So you get a chance to naturally things end up developing anyways. With 16 shows, you're doing live theater. Audiences change every night, so you're getting different reactions, and you're always, something's always adapting or living and breathing and changing and evolving.
Different every night,
I think one of the things we realized early on is there's, at the very end, there's a bit where there's this demon character, and initially they're presented as my lab assistant, for all intents and purposes. And you have this lab assistant that reveals themselves to be a demon, and so the next time you see them is at the very end when we're in hell, and they've changed their makeup, they got a different outfit on, they're much more energetic, like yelling and screaming, like, this is the deal, we're going to take your soul, And kind of tying back to, well, not tying back, I haven't talked about that yet, but a lot of my training through school was through Meisner training, which is very much about putting everything on your partner and listening and receiving, and after doing the table work and knowing the script and knowing the lines and knowing your wants and objectives and all that, you shed that away, you give all that to your partner, and you just respond to what they're giving you. And one of the things that we discovered wasn't even a discovery for me. It was my love interest, Kate, and the demon. There's this little bit where the demon comes on and says, like, what is the actual line? you know, they have a line, they go, that is the deal. And the demon characters started getting like louder and louder every night when they were doing this. And one night they really like, that is the deal, like just screamed it. And so my love interest has a line after that saying, well, now we're making a new deal. And for the first couple of shows, it was defiant, but very much serious, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Like, now we're making a new deal. This is what, da da da. Well, a couple nights in, she kind of throws the seriousness, not away, but she starts matching more the energy we're getting from the demon character. And she goes, that is the deal. She goes, well, now we're making a new deal. She has this ridiculous pose, points at her and everything. And that got the biggest laugh of the run so far. And so once she did that, that was one of the impetuses for all of us to go, okay, we need to play up the silly. No one's going to not believe. Well, A, everything happening is ridiculous anyways. So not everyone needs to be the straight man.
Right.
Obviously. Yeah. We're in hell. I just did a carnival game with my old partner whose life sentence in hell is being a carnival barker. So like nothing makes sense. If this devil's like screaming at us, we can scream back. That's fine. And so that was one of the things we discovered early on. And that helped us. There's another little bit where these two of the other supporting actors who had played other characters in the show put on these demon masks and they run across the stage and they bark and yell at my love interest. And initially they had started out as just like city goers who were drunk, and it was much more like just annoying.
Right.
And then we got these fucking demon masks and they started just barking and making animal noises instead. And that was so much funnier than them trying to be like these, like this underground version of New York and these are just party people, yeah. when they were just ridiculous demon animal things.
Yeah, they're like weird, like twisted satyrs.
Actually, that's the best one. Yeah. And they just made noises instead of trying to be drunk. And that was so much funnier.
It was very.
And I think it was after we did Kate did the whole like an actor's. His name is Charmian Bird, by the way, if you want to follow her. She also streams on Twitch, I think. So go give her some follows. But after she did that kind of like, now we're making a new deal, made that kind of silly, then they started doing these barking animal noises, and we're like, this is absolutely ridiculous. And leaning into that is what unlocked a lot for us. Because then we like added a bit where I chase the demons on at the end, and I bark back at them to get them to go away, and that was like made up, I think, a week into the run. And all of that stuff just worked so much better than trying to play every moment the straight way. And it was those discoveries of silliness that really kept the run going.
I kind of, it was a very strange as an unexpected and fairly delightful twist that like, because so you're on Earth, you go through limbo, purgatory,
back in time a little bit,
back in time, and all of a sudden hell is like where the most fun is.
Yeah.
And there's something there's something pretty twisted and pretty subversive about that really played very well.
It's really funny because the first introduction to this hell place is a carnival barker scene where there's all of a sudden this shooting gallery, and the costume that the guy that's playing my old partner's wearing is this like pinstriped candy cane barbershop quartet outfit.
Yeah,
it's
Van Dyke.
Absolutely ridiculous. And you're like, what is going on? That whole last act became much more fun as the run went on.
I'm
for sure.
Yeah. Well, it was congratulations on
thank
the
you.
Show.
It was
very, very entertaining to watch.
Thank
Your you. Role was very impressive. You did a great job.
Thanks.
I'm curious, what's next?
Ooh,
what's your eye on?
So I'm focusing on the Barrow Group stuff next. I know, not to throw you under the bus, I know that you're planning on doing something soon with your theater company.
Yes.
And so, no pressure, but I am thinking about that. I have adored doing the last two things being original pieces. I absolutely love creating a character and discovering all of the initial stuff myself. Good Lord, do I want to do a show that I know has been written already. And that's no condemnation on any script that I've worked on. It's a different process.
Yeah.
Creating something from the ground up is unbelievably satisfying. And being able to say, because whenever the show gets done, hopefully I'm a part of You Are Not Alone Part 2, Electric Boogaloo, whatever, whenever this version 2 happens, or this version 1.5, whatever Thomas wants to do with it. And I hope he continues, because I do think, like I said, the story has some really nice themes, and I think it's lovely how simple and happy the ending is.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's an important story to keep working on. But that being said, even if he discovers the better version of Dr. Charles Vash in, you know, Timothy Chalamet, whatever is how it's bound to happen. So
takes all our roles.
Right. And so even if it's somebody else, being able to be the first one, or to say that I was the first one to put anything to this character is really something
Absolutely.
Special. But I think the process of taking something that's been done so many times and doing your thing to that is something is satisfying in a very different way that I'm looking to now do.
Absolutely.
The last few things I've been a part of have all been original, and so I really want to sink my teeth into something that people recognize and they can see, oh, that's my stamp on that now. I think that's a different...
Right.
Audiences view that, I think, differently as well. So there's that. I know that Thomas is working on something else over the summer, but I'm really excited to get into this directing program. I want to come out of 2024... feeling confident in my directing ability, having met people through that program that are going to be doing work that I can work with them on, and really shaping myself as an independent theater artist and finding out what my voice is going to be going forward. I think
very cool.
any type of theater I'm able to be a part of is what I want to be doing. There, I don't get the same kind of rush that I do with theater from anything else. And so whatever direction I'm going, it's theater. And I think putting my feelers out to do this directing stuff and now having the chance to do a couple of fairly prominent productions in New York. I'm very excited.
When does the directing program start?
January. It gets going right away.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're
I'm dumb. Soon. I'm dumb jumping in. It's funny because I don't like school, but I love acting school.
Well, because for those listening, acting school is hardly school.
Yeah, and it's much more fun.
Yes, having done a master's program, it's...
Right.
Yeah. Robert Bradfica, do you have handles or anything that we can
if
you
want to follow me on Instagram, it's at Robert L. Bradfica. Bradfica is B-R-A-D-V-I-C-A. I think my picture is like me in a suit, which I got to change soon. I got to get new headshots. but that's my profile picture right now, at Robert L. Bradfica. I unfortunately don't have a website yet. I'm working on that. I also don't have representation. If anyone is listening that represents people, I would love to be represented by somebody.
Yeah. There you go.
It's I love being...
Yeah, come calling.
Yeah, right. It's great being a hustler, but I absolutely hate it.
Right. I would like to be given roles now. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah,
any parting advice for our listeners?
Advice? Oh, man.
Thoughts?
Oh,
theories?
On my way over here, you know those phone charging stands that they have around the city?
Yes.
Those, I forget what they're called, New York Transit, whatever. I saw a picture that was like in New York history, right? The picture was from 2001.
New York history in 2001.
Yeah, it was just like it was black and white too, which bothered me for some reason. It was like New York history.
Back before they had color photographs.
Yeah, 2001. I'm like, I'm used to seeing these say like 1960, 1950. I'm like, why?
Right.
Why?
Interesting.
So that's my thought is I'm old now.
Right. 20 years ago is considered history, and I remember those days very
Good
clearly.
God.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you
fantastic.
For,
thank
for
you so
making
much.
The trip out here.
Oh, of course.
Thank you all for listening in. This has been One Hale of a Conversation. I'm James Hale, and we hope to speak to you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about any of the creatives who spoke in this episode, check out their social media links in the episode description.